thanks so much for staying with us here on Wisconsin Public Radio News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to spend the next hour talking with you about innovative technology in a few areas, but one is to upcycle waste plastics. And Lucas Mastropasqua is our guest today. He is a UW-Madison Assistant Professor of Mechanical Engineering, recently received a federal grant to develop new technology in this area of upcycling. I want to say upscaling. I don't know. Luca, why do we do that? Do you ever make that mistake?
Yeah, upcycling is a difficult term to learn. Yeah.
Well, I'll try to get upcycling into my mind. Luca, by the way, is a assistant professor of mechanical engineering, recently received this grant. And he also runs a lab on campus researching alternative fuels and also keeping carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. So we've got a lot to talk about with him, and we'll start with plastics. Maybe you're concerned about how much plastic ends up in our landfills and polluting the environment. Maybe you wonder what solutions to the climate crisis our UW scientists are pursuing. Would you buy a hydrogen-powered car if hydrogen fueling stations existed outside of the state of California? Join the conversation. The number to call is 800-642-1234. You can email us to talk@wpr.org. And Luca, thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate it very much.
Yeah, thank you for the invitation. It's great to be here.
You know, upcycling versus recycling, what's the difference?
Yes, so upcycling really means trying to create value to something that doesn't have value. So if you think about everything that you throw away, your waste, that for you doesn't have any value anymore. The word upcycling is trying to create processes that give value to a waste stream, a waste product. Mm-hmm. So if we were able to take your trash and and give more value and so that we can either reutilize it in different markets or sell it, sell a product in a with a dollar amount, that means giving value to a waste stream.
So you take an old product and you actually wind up with a product that may be even better than the original product.
Correct. Yeah, and recycling is usually involves transforming, say, an old plastic bag into a water bottle, and that probably that process usually doesn't happen continuously. It cannot happen indefinitely. So the material cannot really withstand that infinite recycle loop. And upcycling often involves a bigger transformation of the product, of your waste. And so that the goal is to increase that recycling, that upcycling and sort of reuse of that molecules. Yeah.
Now, when you were 16 years old, I bet you didn't think, well, you know what, I'm going to be a professor and I'm going to work on upcycling.
Nope.
How did that happen?
That's a wild guess.
How did that interest develop for you?
I'm not a plastic expert. I'm an energy expert. And when I decided to get into engineering, the country where I'm from in Italy, we have energy engineering as a major. So I started doing energy engineering in Milan, Italy, and that brought me to study new technologies for power generation and to increase the energy efficiency of our grid and reducing carbon emissions and so on. And so I started digging into some of the newer technologies, and that involves electrochemical technologies or reactors, and that's then how I got into carbon capture and hydrogen fuels and so on.
Well, you got a federal grant. You traveled to Washington to D.C. to accept a $500,000 federal research grant, and that's going to support your research on waste plastic upcycling. What's the process you hope to develop?
Yeah, so for that grant, I started thinking, as I said, I'm an energy expert, so I started thinking about the plastic problem as an energy problem and not as a material problem. So the motivation of the work is really trying to displace the use of fossil fuels for producing plastics. So today, only about 7% of the plastics that we produce is recycled. And so there is a large amount of plastics that is wasted.
93% of it, from the sound of it.
Yep. It's a great majority of it. And a lot, as we know, a lot of it goes into our oceans and it's really mismanaged. And to produce that plastic, we use a lot of fossil fuels. We use a lot of the resources that we either produce here in the U.S. or we have to import. And that brings sort of consequent CO2 emissions that we emit in the atmosphere for producing that plastic products. Especially, it's around 15% of the total CO2 emissions globally we emit it just to produce plastics.
How much was it?
15.
Oh, 15. I thought you said 50.
No, 15. It's still sort of a... It's still a lot, yes. So that amount of CO2 can be eliminated if we found a way to not use fossil fuels to produce that initial plastic product. So, as I said, it's an energy problem. And to produce the plastic products that we currently use, we need petrochemicals. We need molecules that are currently produced in refineries mainly, or chemical plants, that use fossil fuels as an energy source. So those molecules are what I try to produce from waste plastics in this project. So the goal is to take waste plastics, put them in a reactor that will be able to produce the feedstock, the molecules that we generally need to produce the original plastic products, but we produce that feedstock from fossil fuels. So if we were able to recover waste plastics and produce the original feedstock that we need to produce the plastic products in its first place, we would eliminate the fossil fuel component of the petrochemical industry. So again, we have a lot of resource because the waste plastic that we just throw away is
thrown away.
Enormous. Yeah. So has a lot of both energy and sort of molecular value for a chemical process. So we could recover a lot of energy and recover a lot of molecules that are valuable. So we just need that technology that is able to get take waste and produce feedstock products, feedstock molecules, using renewable energy. So the reactor that I will be developing this project will be taking electricity from solar or wind, for example, and converting waste plastics into these feedstock molecules. And just to give a couple of names, these would be ethylene or propylene. These are the building blocks that that then go into the chemical industry to build polymers, plastics. So polyethylene, polypropylene, and so on.
Yeah. What are the petrochemical companies or industry, how do they feel about that work?
I think it would
I think
be,
they'd like I, it. I would think they'd like it.
I think they would like it. It's the these are processes that will take what they are used to use, they're used to handle in their chemical processes, in their refineries, and these are they will need to convert their processes to eliminate CO2 emissions from fossil fuel use. And a petrochemical industry is growing, will be growing. It's currently growing at a pace that it doesn't seem to be slowing down. Yeah. So it's this process will help petrochemical industry transition towards a low carbon fuel, but still utilizing the same sort of infrastructure that they currently use today.
That's pretty cool. So you're taking a machine. I'll put it that way. You're taking a machine. You're running the plastics through it. Mm-hmm. You're sort of separating out these molecules or feedstocks, which I love that use of that term, into something that can then be made into another product that's actually better than the first one that was there.
Yeah, you will be able to produce feedstock that will be used to, for example, produce more plastics.
Yeah.
The input stream is zero value. It's waste. It doesn't have any value for anybody who throws away because they throw it away. So the product will be a feedstock that is currently produced in the petrochemical industry. So the ethylene, for example, will be a feedstock for producing polyethylene polymers. So we could make plastic bottles that do not use fossil fuels. It would just take waste plastic bottles, and you could, in theory, close the loop of the plastic cycle using only renewable electricity.
Woo! That's pretty cool. Would the process eliminate carbon dioxide?
The interesting part is that
the primary cause of climate change, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, so that's a good point. So it will eliminate the release of carbon in the atmosphere. So the carbon, plastics are very valuable molecules because they contain a lot of valuable atoms. So they contain carbon, they contain hydrogen, and a lot of other additives. And that's why it's a waste throwing them away. So the carbon will stay within the plastic loop. It will not get released as CO2 in the atmosphere in this process. We will be able to break down polymers that contain carbon and produce these molecules that also contain carbon, and we'll keep the carbon...
Keep the loop.
Keep the carbon in the plastic loop. If we used plastic waste for example, fuels production or for energy production. So if we incinerated plastics, that carbon would be released. It would be oxidized and would be released as CO2. So the goal here is to not produce fuels, use plastics for energy generation so that we don't emit CO2.
Luca Mastropasqua, our guest today, he is an assistant professor of mechanical engineering, and he's doing some pretty cool research, isn't he? I love this idea. You may have questions about it. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about some innovative approaches, this one to upcycle plastic. And there's a UW-Madison large grant that is looking into this. And our guest today, Luca Mastropasqua, an assistant professor of mechanical engineering at UW-Madison, our guest today to talk about it and some other things as well we're going to get into as we move along with him. Join in, numbers 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Dave, who's driving in Iron County right now. Dave, thank you for calling.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, the question or maybe suggestion is for the professor to clarify the source of original plastic, which I believe is oil, versus his, which is recycled plastic. He hasn't mentioned oil yet. He's talked a lot about energy, which is great. And then both processes, his reactors, of course, use energy, whether it's the oil refinery or his novel process. And I would just like, I would just be curious, the volumes of those energy respectively, or, you know, forecasts on energy savings there. He calls it renewable, but, you know, that renewable could come from anything. Is it heat form, electricity? That's it. I'll stop there.
All right. Thanks for calling. Luca?
Yeah, thanks for the question. So the current plastic is produced from oil. Most of the feedstocks that we currently use for producing plastics, or one of the big one is ethane. So it is derived from oil or natural gas. The plastics that I would take as feedstock in my reactor will be a waste, will be the plastic that it's today produced from fossil fuels. If you imagine this process scaled up in the future, all the plastic can be part of this loop of upcycling and reuse. So ultimately, there will be a transition towards not using oil to make that original feedstock, but keep on converting back and forth these molecules using electricity. So my reactor will not use oil as energy source. It will use electricity. And you're right, the electricity, it depends the source of electricity that you use. Mm-hmm. So it depends where you live. And depending on which state you live in, the source of electricity will differ. My goal is to power this reactor with renewable electricity. So we will have simulated solar and wind electricity profile that will be coupled to this reactor to show that the reactor can be connected directly to a solar photovoltaic plant or a wind farm. Oil is currently in the picture today, certainly, because we need that to produce the feedstock for making today's plastics. The goal is to, if you imagine this process scaled up, is to eliminate that part to produce the feed, eliminate the oil to produce the feedstock, mm-hmm. and keep on converting waste into products, products into waste, and vice versa. In terms of energy savings, this is a very it's a great question, and at the moment we I only have predictions. I don't have measured data yet, because we just started.
Well, that's
started.
What the process, the 500,000
exactly.
bucks is for.
So my expectations is that I would be able to improve the energy efficiency of the process by approximately 70 or 80% compared to the current status. And in terms of CO2 emissions, as I said, because we will eliminate the use of fossil fuels to making plastics, CO2 emissions will also be saved of the order of 70%.
That would be absolutely amazing. Now, where are you getting all the plastics you're going to be? Is everybody saving all of the plastic? Or how are you, what's this process like?
Yeah, so one of the greatest challenges that any upcycling process has, not just mine, is that when we, in our homes, when we take our plastic products and throw them away. We put all those plastic products in one single bin. What we don't know is that all these plastic products are very different to each other. The polymers that make them up are very different in their molecular form.
Sure.
So we need to be able to separate the different polymers in order to make this process easier to produce the feedstock that we really need for the petrochemical industry. So there is a challenge in terms of collection and separation of our plastic trash, mm-hmm. such that we can sort of selectively convert the polymers that we are interested in. I foresee working with collection systems and like municipalities to understand how that process can be how my process can be incorporated into their collection system, and if there is any changes that needs to be made into either my system process layout or in the collection process.
Peter in Eden emailed us to say, according to the book "Can I Recycle This?" by Jennifer Romer, only low number plastics 1, 2, and 3, not 5, 6 or higher, can be recycled. Is this factual? And what makes these plastics unable to be recycled, or can they be used in your process?
Yeah, so that's it's true. So plastic. So again, let's go back at recycling versus upcycling. Mm-hmm. Recycling today usually means taking a plastic product or plastic waste and mechanically shredding it.
Yeah.
Often that means making it in small plastic particles, and that plastic particle is rethreaded or melted and molded into a new product. This mechanical process can only be done so many times because the polymers will degrade if you keep on shredding them and remolding them and so on and so forth. So this cycle is not infinite. The reason why not every polymer, not every plastic can be recycled is that, and this is clear even from our sort of day-to-day life, there are plastics that are much harder than others.
Yeah.
So if you take a plastic bottle, the plastic is different to the plastic that you have in your phone or that make up some of the components in your car. Because they have different mechanical properties, they have different additives. The additives are a major challenge that, as I mentioned earlier, these wastes are very diverse. And if you have additives or colorant, like if you have a black plastic, if you have a transparent plastic, those are different additives that are added to the polymer when you make a product. So the recycling of a plastic product entails being able to manage all this diversity of additives and different polymer structures, so that we can make a new product that has the characteristics that we want. You know, of course, we don't want recycled plastic bags then don't hold their load, you know, or their break. So we want to make sure that recycled products have the correct mechanical properties and requirements. So all of these additives and diverse polymers needs to be managed in the recycling as well as in my process to create new products.
But you can still use, well, your research is looking at which plastics will I be able to use, or do you know that intuitively?
Yeah, so I will start working with polyethylene and polypropylene, as well as polystyrene. So polystyrene is what you usually see in packaging, for mm-hmm. example. Polypropylene and polyethylene are used for bottles and plastic bags. So those are products that I will be able to take from any supermarket and try directly into the reactor that I will be developing.
I'm trying to envision how this might look. 'Cause those products, I mean, they take up a lot of space. Are you going to be crushing them down, or is there some sort of a hopper that is on top that you push it through, or what?
Yeah, so the goal here is to, reduce the size. As you said, the volume is large, so we need to reduce the size. So there will be some mechanical sort of shredding without... again, changing the molecule, the molecular nature of the plastic. So there will be some mechanical shredding, and then the goal is to extrude the plastic waste into the reactor. So the technology is similar to what we currently use for additive manufacturing. So 3D printing of plastic products is being developed, and it's pretty it's a growing market. So there are ways of extruding plastics to make a filament,
mm-hmm.
And that filament can be more easily fed into a chemical reactor.
Okay, all right. That makes sense. Jim in Menominee has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to let your listeners know of an example of some combination recycling, upcycling, and recycling that is being done by the American Birkebeiner Ski Race up in Hayward. The racing bibs with the numbers on are made for us by a company down in La Crosse, and the bibs are made from recycled plastic water bottles for the race. And after the race, some people have turned in their bibs. Some bibs are not picked up. Some people don't show up for whatever reason for the race. And so every year the Berkey has hundreds of these extra bibs. Well, what the Birch Leggings Club of the American Birkebeiner has done is upcycled some of these. We've taken the bibs, sewn them into shopping bags, sewed up the bottoms, and make some great shopping bags. And there are a couple of folks with the Birch Leggings Club who have taken extra bibs and made them into quilts and ski bags, mittens. Some really colorful, great-looking things. We've recycled and upcycled the recycled material. Just this past weekend, a group of Birch Leggings Club members met up in Hayward, and we processed the bibs to be recycled again, the extra bibs. We removed the racing timing chips from the bibs, and now the bibs are going to be sent, I believe, to a company out in the East Coast. And the bibs, which are already made of recycled material, are going to be recycled again. We've kind of completed the whole circle here.
Okay. Well, is that upcycling or is it recycling? All of that recycling.
I think that's probably what's considered recycling. The upcycling, it really depends if you increase the value of the product, but that's a great example. I think I'll make sure to give my bib back when I complete my Berkey next year.
And that's a pretty cool idea, just to be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
I like it, Jim. Thank you for calling. Chuck and Eagle, your turn. Hi, Chuck.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And I have a question for your guest.
Sure.
A little background real quick. I was in the plastics industry for 34 years, and mainly we focused on consumer packaging, which had an array or a rainbow of colors added, pigments and dyes used to get corporations their marketing aspects of color. So the question I have is, in taking the polypropylene that has colorants in it from packaging, can that still be used in what he is proposing of taking feedstock from those materials and turning it into energy again?
Yeah, so that's great, great point and great question. I think it is one of the challenges for, again, any of the upcycling processes that people are developing. The dyes and additives that I mentioned earlier are one of the big problems. So either we need to be able to separate those additives before we feed the waste into the upcycling, whatever reactor it's going to be. Or the reactor needs to be able to withstand those dyes and additives while still producing the correct product. So it is a challenge at the moment for the technology that I'm developing, which is an electrochemistry based process. I don't currently know if it's how sensitive this is going to be to additives or dyes. For other technologies that are usually based on thermochemical reactors, there might be a different sensitivity to dyes and additives, but it's still not a fully proven process. So it is a challenge.
Yeah, but it's part of why you're doing the research.
Yeah, that's why we need to study these processes.
Yeah, absolutely. Chuck, thank you very much. Pete and Racine, we'll go to you. Hi, Pete.
Thank you. I'm very enthusiastic about your guest. Okay, and I've seen outside of a grocery store 3,700 plastic shopping bags, the cheapy, thin types, compressed and melted or whatever and formed into a park bench. And it was a rigid, durable-seeming park bench, which is great. And then they do collect bags at the grocery stores, clean bags they have to be. Now, I remember working at a food bank. We needed bags for cheap, and I had to collect those bags and had to examine each and every one of them because some piggy person threw in a bag with a diaper in there.
Well... Plastic bags. You're going to do this with plastic bags?
Yes. Plastic bags are going to be one of the first products that we're going to try with to feed to these reactors.
Pete, thanks. Beth and Madison, your turn. Hi, Beth.
Hello, Larry.
Hi.
This is Dr. Beth Neary. I have a question, and my question involves, while we're talking about plastics and we're talking about plastic recycling, I think it's really important to know that in the production of plastics, there's many toxicants that are used, such as in the production of polystyrene, a.k.a. styrofoam, they use ethylene, benzene, and benzene is actually a known carcinogen. So I think the bottom line is we have to reduce the amount of plastics because there's also toxic chemicals used in their production.
Beth, thanks a lot. Comment on that, Luca?
Yeah, that's. I totally agree. This is definitely not in. This process definitely doesn't justify the use or abuse of plastics. Further, we certainly need to go in the direction of making bioplastics or biodegradable plastics, and this sort of doesn't compete with going in those directions as well. Ethylene and benzene are chemicals that are produced in large amounts in the chemical industry, and it's true that they have major health impacts. So it's something that we need to manage and reduce as much as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Beth, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Stephen kind of wants us to talk about about hydrogen and hydrogen cars, and I think we can get to, maybe we'll get to that next. I'm Larry Mueller, our guest today, Luca Mastropasqua from the University of Wisconsin. He's an assistant professor of mechanical engineering. I'm Larry Mueller. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Luca Mastropasqua, who is an assistant professor of mechanical engineering at UW-Madison. Great to have him with us to talk about his research. We've been looking at his kind of innovative approach to upcycling plastic, and it his work has earned a nice grant, a federal grant to look into this process. Questions for him about that or something else, I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. And you're also, you're director of the Hydrogen and Electrochemical Research for Decarbonization Lab, or I like the acronym for it, HERD Lab, within UW-Madison's Department of Mechanical Engineering. What's the overall focus of the work in that lab?
Yeah, so our lab focuses, so I wanted to have those three key words in my name, in the lab name, hydrogen, electrochemistry, and decarbonization. So the lab focuses on integrating electrochemical processes into either hard to decarbonize transportation sectors or industrial sectors, and with the overall goal of reducing or eliminating CO2 emissions. Both hydrogen and electrochemistry are, I think, tools that we can use to get to decarbonization in some of the hard to decarbonize sectors. So that's why they are in the name. And in terms of research activities, we span from production of hydrogen or hydrogen derivatives for the transportation sector, the use of hydrogen or hydrogen derivatives in fuel cells for electricity generation with high efficiency, or the integration of electrochemical devices to do carbon capture, to do chemical synthesis, like the plastic project, for example, with the, again, goal to integrate these in the industry.
Let's talk about the hydrogen-powered vehicles in the U.S., and you're doing some work in that hydrogen area, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, there's 16,000, I think, hydrogen-powered cars operating in the state of California, which is the only place.
Yep.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so the U.S. Has about 55, I think, refueling stations, hydrogen refueling stations that are open to the public, and they're all in California. There are many more scattered around the nations that are not open to the public, and that serve private customers. Mm. So if you look, for example, at USPS or a lot of warehouses of major
corporations,
major industry that move a lot of material, their warehouses is often powered by hydrogen forklifts. Our mail is moved in warehouses by hydrogen forklifts. Not completely, but in a large amount by hydrogen forklifts. So we know, the industry knows how to dispense hydrogen and to use hydrogen-powered vehicles, at least for the movement of goods in warehouses. And we are transitioning, at least some sectors are transitioning towards the movement of people around in our streets. So
what's the advantage of hydrogen versus, let's say, a regular electric vehicle? I mean, we've got, 3 million at least electric vehicles out there.
So first of all, I just want to make, because this is a debated topic.
Okay.
And so hydrogen fuel cells vehicles are also electric vehicles.
Yeah.
The hydrogen fuel cell vehicles have a fuel cell that substitutes our internal combustion engine, gasoline car engine. And then the fuel cell produces electricity. And that electricity is used to run an electric motor. So the feeling that you have when you drive a fuel cell vehicle is the same as the one that you would have driving a battery electric vehicle. They are both electric vehicles. I don't see competition between fuel cell electric vehicles and battery electric vehicles.
Okay.
They shouldn't be exclusive, mutually exclusive. The advantage of using hydrogen fuel cell vehicles comes when you start looking at heavy duty applications. So if you start thinking about pickup trucks or delivery trucks or buses for metro transit authorities or class 8 trucks for the movement of goods across the nation, or trucks that are used in ports, and those are usually in low-income communities with a lot of problems of pollution. Those trucks are very hard to convert into battery electric vehicles because the load that they need to move is so much more than for a light-duty vehicle, a passenger car. So when you want to move a heavy payload, battery electric vehicles are struggle today because they don't have the power, the energy density, and the power density to match that. So at least today, and of course, both fuel cells and battery electric technologies are improving as we speak.
Yeah, of course.
So that's how I see their application today.
Okay, so. Are we going to, you think we'll see, continue to see many more of the hydrogen vehicles or hydrogen in use in various types of vehicles and in different types of situations?
Yeah, I think there are many companies that are developing hydrogen fuel cell trucks or hydrogen fuel cell buses. And the economics compared to fleets of battery electric vehicles is competitive when you think about buses and trucks. Mm-hmm. Also, hydrogen fuel cell vehicles will be competitive when you start thinking about planes or trains. So again, when you want to move a lot of a heavy payload, and you want to go far. So your range needs to be long. That is when hydrogen fuel cell vehicles start to make sense, especially, again, if you want to compare them with battery electric vehicles. So there is, I think, a transition that is happening towards those type of applications.
Joel Patnott, our producer for today, mentioned something about electrolysis technology. Okay, and I didn't catch it all. So what is this technology and something you're working on?
Yeah, so electrolysis is, so when you think about a fuel cell is you take hydrogen and air and you put it inside a fuel cell and you produce electricity. That's a fuel cell.
Okay.
Electrolysis is the opposite. So you take electricity and water, and you split the molecule of water with electricity to produce hydrogen and oxygen.
I see.
So it's the exact opposite of a fuel cell. The fuel cell will emit only water as a product. Electrolysis will take water as a reactant, as a feed stream. It will split the molecule of water into hydrogen and oxygen. So electrolysis is a way, it's not the only way, but it's a way to produce hydrogen, pure hydrogen, for all of these applications. And it's the way that it's currently being studied the most because it allows to produce hydrogen using direct renewable electricity. So if you had a wind farm or a solar panel, you could take an electrolyzer and water and produce hydrogen and oxygen.
That would be very cool if you could upscale that to...
Yeah, believe it or not, there are companies that are already commercializing these systems. And so you, if you wanted one today, you could go and buy an electrolyzer.
Well, that really is fascinating to me. Carbon capture and storage is kind of another area, and you know, we don't have a lot of time left here, but what are you most excited about in this area?
Yeah, so carbon capture and storage has been developed for many, many years. My role or my contribution has been on industrial emissions. So again, if you take, for example, refineries, or if you take steel plants or cement plants, those are very difficult to convert into electric processes. So it's very difficult to just take electricity that it's produced from solar panels or wind farms and convert a steelmaking process just by using electricity, because of the temperatures involved, because of reactions involved. So the one way to reduce the emissions of those applications, of those processes, is by taking the flue gas stream, which is mainly comprised of CO2 and water, and separate the CO2 from that stream. So there are electrochemical technologies that I've worked on in the past that are able, they're membrane-based, so the membrane is selective to CO2 and not water. So if you have a gaseous stream of CO2 and water, the membrane is able to selectively remove the CO2 from the gaseous stream and concentrate the CO2 in its own gaseous stream, and so that can then be compressed and then either used or sort of stored underground or used for other applications. The use of CO2, it's a totally different topic, which we might not have the time to go into, but the capture process is trying to develop technologies that selectively separate CO2 from a gaseous stream. So, and the ultimate example is separating CO2 from air. So there are a lot of technologies that are being developed that are called direct air capture, DAC, where you take air and develop membranes or adsorbent technologies that simply remove CO2 from air.
Wow. So where would you put, I mean, you'd have, I'm trying to think of where you would, how it would be used.
So the reason why it's important to develop those technologies is that there will always be applications where it's going to be very hard to completely decarbonize. So take, for example, planes. Planes are really hard to decarbonize. So even if we use biofuels, we might have CO2 emissions emitted when the plane burns biofuels.
But those filters could capture that.
Exactly. So we could deploy membranes on the ground that remove CO2 from air to compensate from the fact that some processes will always emit some of the CO2.
We're going to have to talk some more about this with you. Here we are out of time. I want to thank you so much, Luca, for being with us today. It was fun, and I learned a lot. I think everybody else did as well, so appreciate your time. Luca Mastropasqua, an assistant professor of mechanical engineering at the UW-Madison, our guest today. Great to have him with us. I'm always pleased to have a great group of people that are helping, and really together we produce this show. Joel Patnod, Clara Neipert, our guest today, Jeff Robbins, our technical director, Lee Rayburn, also another technical director, and Jill Nadeau, our executive producer. I'm Larry Mueller.